Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Master of Educational Technology at UBC's podcast for our Anti-Racism Speaker Series. My name is Dr. Carrie Ewart, and I'm a faculty member for the Master of Educational Technology program, what we call MET at UBC, and the EDIDA coordinator and designer of the Anti-Racism Speaker Series. I have with me EDI Graduate Academic Assistant Tamika Fisher. Thank you for joining us. For our listeners, one of the ways that we begin meetings in Canada is to acknowledge the Indigenous people who have taken land we benefit. This is a part of a broader national truth and reconciliation effort in Canada and at UBC. I'm speaking on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. Our podcast booth, MET offices, and servers are located on this territory. I am honored, humbled, and fortunate, and appreciative to work and play on this land. I recognize the historical wrongdoings, violence, erasure of Indigenous cultures, traditions, values, and peoples at the hands of the Canadian government. I strive in my own practice and the role of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Coordinator to learn, unlearn, and relearn from a decolonized lens in order to understand, raise awareness, and educate in order to reach a place of equity between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. A more expansive statement on our commitment to Canada's 94 calls to action can be found on our MET website as the statement on commemorating Canada's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation 2023, with supporting resources. These calls to action invite us to commit to changes. MET has launched a series of podcasts that will explore the role of education and technology in social justice and anti-racism as part of this call. Tamika, would you like to present your territorial acknowledgement?
Thank you, Carrie. I'm an uninvited settler and blessed to work at UBC, and I thank the Musqueam First Nation for the privilege of working and studying on their ancestral and stolen territory. I also respectfully acknowledge that I'm communicating from the ancestral, traditional, and stolen territories of the Kwantlen and Catesay First Nations and the Coast Salish peoples. I am and my ancestors are from the island of Honshu in Japan, although my settler grandfather was born on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Musqueam, Tsawwassen, and Kwantlen First Nations, and my settler mother was born on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Lower Kootenai First Nation. I'm grateful to my hosts, all of my hosts, for the privilege of studying, living, working, and recreating in this beautiful place, and thank them for their stewardship. I have been learning and unlearning in my practice as I work towards a fuller understanding of my responsibilities to work towards reconciliation and against Indigenous racism and harms. My intention today is to bear witness to Agam Darshi's teaching and to learn how to support learners in anti-racism.
Thank you so much. So, the Master of Educational Technology program educates professionals on the use and the impact of digital learning technologies. This fully online graduate program provides a unique opportunity for our students to engage in topics such as the role ed tech in racism and anti-racism. Since the degree program launched in 2002, close to 2,000 students have enrolled in UBC's MET program, with more than 450 students enrolled currently. MET dedicates itself to supporting its learners, stakeholders, and the public to make a positive change in communities. What is the speaker series about, and what are we talking about in this podcast, Tamika?
Thanks, Carrie. The purpose of the speaker series is to acknowledge the commitment that every individual has to inclusivity and addressing systemic racism. With a focus on anti-Indigenous, anti-Black, and anti-people of color racism, this series seeks to identify the responsibility educators and leaders have to facilitating and supporting anti-racist approaches and strategies within their practice to enhance and transform learning environments and learning cultures. With a specific directive being digital technologies, presenters and guests will discuss racism and tools to support equity, diversity, inclusivity, and the changing dynamics of the digital age.
As a result, at MET, we are committed to a follow-up to each presentation of the speaker series with a call to action challenge. We invite listeners to make one change this month, no matter how small, and to share it with us as a next step to this podcast to eradicate racism through community building, education, and through the use of educational technologies. This call to action provides you the opportunity as listeners of this podcast to build on the anti-racist content from this session and make steps towards change. For example, you might integrate what you've heard and thought about from this podcast with a lesson plan that you'll bring awareness to the issues of racism for students, colleagues, and friends. We will provide you with more detail about this call for proposals at the end of the podcast.
And with that, the topic for today's podcast is Behind the Lens, Navigating Identity in Film. Carrie?
Thank you. On today's episode, we are so honored to welcome Agam Darshi, who goes by the pronouns of she, her. Agam Darshi is an international award-winning actress and filmmaker, having worked alongside Oscars-nominated director Deepa Mehta and Emmy winner Ava DuVernay. Agam Darshi's directorial debut, Donkey Head, which Agam wrote and starred in, was financed by the Telefilm Canada, acquired by Array Now, and released on Netflix in January 2022 in US, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. It won Best Feature Film Award, Best Support Actor, and Best Editing at MISA, and won Best Director at the Vancouver Women's International Film Festival in 2022. It was nominated for 11 Leo Awards and won Best Lead Actress and Best Screenplay for Agam. Agam won Best Director at the 43rd Durban International Film Festival and was nominated for Outstanding Achievement in a Feature Film at the 2022 DGC Awards. Agam won Best Lead Actress at the UBCP ACTRA Awards in 2022 for her role in Donkey Head. In 2018, Donkey Head was one of only six scripts accepted into the Whistler Film Festival's Praxis Screenwriter Lab and was awarded a $2,000 grant by the St. John's Women's Film Festival in collaboration with the DGC. In the fall of 2022, Agam co-created a series on Omni entitled Our Big Punjabi Family, a half-hour single-cam comedy about a Punjabi family living in BC. Agam has continued directing for television and recently wrapped an episode of Allegiance for CBC. Agam is the recipient of the illustrious film independent project Evolve 2020 Fellowship as a writer and the co-founder of ISAF, the Vancouver International South Asian Film Festival, which is currently in its 14th year. On this episode, we delve into the complex intersections of identity, representation, and storytelling. Agam Darshi will share her personal journeys and professional insights through the exploration of topics ranging from the impact of technology and shifting industry dynamics to the evolving narratives of underrepresented communities, highlighting the transformations for marginalized and oppressed IBPOC individuals in the film industry. From discussions on South Asian narrative to unpacking the toll of colonialism on film, this episode offers a deep dive into the multifaceted layers of race, gender, and culture in cinema. In this episode, we seek to examine the role of education in fostering inclusivity and anti-racism within the industry. From challenging notions of authorship to navigating the complexities of intersectionality, this dialogue will shed light on both the progress made and the obstacles yet to overcome. You are a renowned actor, writer, and director. So nice to have you here with us, Agam. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Now, please share with us how you got into the role.
I have a degree from University of Calgary in visual arts. I have a BFA in visual arts with a focus in photography and a minor in theater. And when I ended up moving to Vancouver soon after, I was encouraged to get an agent. And so I did without much expectation. And then I ended up booking my first audition and it ended up just sort of escalating from there. And that was probably about 18 years ago now. And then throughout that time, I went back to school, I studied screen. And so I've just been, you know, working as an actor and as a filmmaker in tandem since then.
That's very impressive. Thank you so much. Tamika.
Agam, can you please tell us about the film that you most recently produced and acted in? What is the premise?
Yeah, the film is called Donkey Head, and it's about a woman named Mona Guman who has been, she's a failure at life. She's a failed writer, and she's been caring for her ailing traditional South Asian father for the past 7 years. And when his health takes a turn for the worst, her three very successful siblings come back home to take care of the situation. So it's a film about family. It's a film about starting over. It's a coming of age film a few decades late, because traditionally we tend to see coming of age stories as being something that happens when you're 16 and beautiful. But you know, she's almost inching 30, oh, sorry, 40, and there's nothing not beautiful about that, but it's just traditionally we don't usually see people kind of really having to start over at that age. So yeah, it was a lot of fun to make.
It was a beautiful film. I just want to say I watched it and it felt the emotions were so real.
Thank you so much.
I really noticed that.
You know, it's so funny. You make films and you never know who's actually going to have a chance to watch it. And when they do, it just feels, it's amazing to me. I'm like, wow, you spent 2 hours of your life to watch this film. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
It is. And I love that you created this premise that was so outside that status quo, that norm, that coming of age. And I think in society, we've seen a new round of coming of age. And it's not necessarily with so much going on, that new coming of age tends to be older and older. And I love that you introduced everybody to that particular piece. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Now, just in your career and in all the things that you do, what would you say have been your greatest transformations or the greatest transformation that you've seen in the industry since you started, maybe both positive and negative?
I feel like over the last, 18 years that I've been acting and making films, I think story has just become more nuanced, and when you really think about it, the film industry is not that old, it's about 100 years old, but story obviously is very, very old. But I feel like we're still very much at the beginning of what it is to make film. And so I think over the last few decades, we've seen stories and characters just become a lot more specific, a lot more nuanced, which is really exciting, right? Because within specificity, there's universality. And so I think as a result, we're connecting more and we're seeing more of ourselves and others. So that's a positive part. In terms of the transformation that perhaps is a little more negative, I mean, I think the pendulum has been swinging just in terms of the politics of story and as it should, but I do think as a result, I feel like a lot of artists now are feeling sort of the pressure to get it right. I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of questions these days about like, well, where is the art in this? If I have to be so like correct in my opinion. And the fact is human opinion and humanism and the way we behave is not correct. It's flawed. It's messy. It's ugly. We are all full of sort of our own judgments. So where does that live if you're trying to create truth in story? And especially because people are so fast, like we have these keyboard warriors who, want to give their opinion about things, but don't necessarily want to show their face, with those opinions. And so people can get really clawed down fast if they misstep or if they have an opinion that perhaps is unpopular. There's very little room for discussion these days. And a lot of judgment instead. And so I think that's what I'm seeing.
That's interesting that you say that, because in the past it was expert critiques that would actually watch and critique the film and provide a very extensive overview and their opinion of the film. But that was basically premised and based in their own expertise and the schooling and the experiences that they've had. Where nowadays everybody's an expert or thinks they're an expert. And it has opened up the social media and multimedia has opened this incredible lens in some ways for people to have a voice and to be honored and, you know, in something that wasn't necessarily there in the past, but at the same time, it adds that hindrance. So even though those narratives, more and more people are speaking their truths, more and more people are critiquing those truths and not necessarily based on a very solid framework of evidence. So it's interesting that you mentioned that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great that we have that ability to say our opinions. I think the issue, though, is that it's no longer a dialogue. You know, it's now just a judgment and you're canceled, you know. And so I've seen that, unfortunately, a lot where people aren't even listening. I think that's really what it comes down to.
And that critical dialogue is so important because it has both senses of understanding. So thank you very much, Tamika.
How has technology impacted your industry, Agam?
Yeah, I mean, COVID happened and everything became very independent, you know, in a lot of ways. So as an actor, for example, prior to COVID, you used to drive to your audition like they have for many, many decades. And you had a little bit of an audience. You had a casting director there watching you perform. And now everybody auditions from home, which is incredibly beneficial, you know, especially if you're traveling or whatnot. But it's basically your audience is your, in my case, my husband, who reads with me when I'm doing my audition. And you just don't really know who sees the audition. So it's just basically become like this very sort of personal experience to audition and to perform. AI is also a huge topic these days as well. And that's the reason why, you know, the strikes happened over this past year. And just sort of what is the place of technology and AI and where does creativity come from? And can AI actually replace like our own human creativity or not? You know, it's something that I think a lot of people in the industry are really afraid of. And then also I think just because of the rapid growth of technology, just using something like our iPhones to be able to make movies these days has made it so much cheaper to be able to tell a story, which is really exciting because it used to honestly require hundreds of thousands of dollars to make a film. And now, you know, you can make one on your iPhone, edit it really well, and then just throw it up on YouTube and see what happens. And so that is actually really exciting. And then just what we consider to be story and the stories we create on social media, those little 1-2 minute bits, like that is a way for us to get our voice out there as well. So it's become so much more accessible, which is incredible and exciting and also kind of hard to wrap our heads around, especially I find for myself being older and having grown up with actual feature length movies to have to think about creating a story that's 2 minutes long and what I want to say. Like I have a really hard time sort of shifting my own perspective about that and how to do it. But it seems like kids these days can do it. So it's interesting.
You know, it's interesting that you're talking about social media and the 2 minute bits. You know, I agree. It's great that it's a lot more open. Now, do you find that because of social media that people's attention spans are getting a little bit shorter or no?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you have to really kind of, especially for TV, I see this more. But when you're directing for TV, when you're writing for TV, there's just so much more that's required to make sure that it's snappy, that it's edited well, so that somebody doesn't change the channel. I think with film, we still sort of have a little bit of leeway, at least for like independent film, where we can take our time and let a story sort of like slowly evolve. But yeah, generally speaking, people want to sort of see a barrage of information. I mean, we're also faster at processing. It's not good or bad. It's just sort of the evolution of how we're thinking of media, of how story is being told. And maybe in some ways it's good. I mean, when you look at the film, I'm just thinking about Everything Everywhere All at Once. I mean, it was such a great film. And, but it was, it just, it talked about so many things and it was a barrage and it was all different genres. And it just felt like you were going on a ride. Like it was just so well done, I felt. So I think it's really exciting in terms of just how we're processing information and then how we're going to be able to tell those stories. But it's definitely a learning curve, I think, for a lot of us.
Funny, Time Magazine published an article indicating that humans' attention span is less than that of a goldfish. And they're saying in this day and age, it's less than 6 seconds. So within the first 6 seconds, you almost need to capture that audience. And who knows how much truth is to that, you know, but at the same time, it just demonstrates that wave of where we're going, where we've been, how things are transient and changing consistently. And with that, I'm wondering the notion of whiteness, where does that enter into the industry?
Yeah. So in terms of the notion of whiteness, I mean, I think that the whole industry is based on whiteness. And I think the easiest sort of understanding of that is what is the story? Who is our hero? Who supports the hero? Usually, you know, the IBPOC folk are the ones who are cast as supporting characters who help the hero attain their dreams, you know. But it goes beyond that in terms of also, you know, it goes beyond what the story is and the authorship of the story and who we cast. It actually is also about who's behind the lens. How are we lighting the faces that we see, you know, because usually like it's a very small, it seems like a very small technical thing, but usually the white fair skin is the baseline. And anything that is darker than that will, I've seen shows like that are not that old where it's like, wow, that dark skinned person is not lit very well. It's not very flattering. And so who is behind that camera? Who's making those judgments? Who's the makeup artist? You know, how are we beautifying these faces? Who's the hairstylist? Has that hairstylist worked with black hair before? And then once you actually make the thing, how are we branding it? Who are the faces on the billboard? You know, so it really just trickles down as to who we're placing on that pedestal and who we want our audiences to connect to.
That was really, really well answered. And I think really looking at perspective, and when we bring this back to the idea of technology, we look at algorithmic bias all the time. And so often you go into a bathroom and put your hands underneath the what is supposed to be an automatic dispenser. And it was created and designed with the white person in mind and that skin tone and color. And same thing with unlocking iPhones at the beginning. And same thing with, you know, who is behind that lens? Who is the decision maker? Who is it representative of all communities and all people, or is it specifically geared towards that whiteness? So I really love that answer. I think that was really fantastic and so much alignment with so many other areas as well. Thanks, Aga.
Thank you for the question. It's been really great because these are things that I have obviously lived over the last, you know, few decades, but sometimes you don't even realize that you've been living it because you're just in the process of sort of survival and just kind of doing the thing. And then having to really sort of analyze it is fascinating and somewhat heartbreaking as well, you know.
But I think important to you as a director, because you as a director could help guide and have others be cognizant of as well. And those are those really critical and tricky conversations sometimes, but conversations that need to have in order to alter the discourse and alter those next steps moving forward. Thank you very much. Tomika.
What do you feel is the greatest resistance in the industry that you encounter today? It's a big question.
I think the greatest resistance is that is a huge question. But I think the thing that's coming to me is just that we're so attached to our identity, you know, and I think identity does need to change, and the way we perceive ourselves has to change, and the way we perceive others has to change. Yeah, it's just so fascinating because of what is happening in the world politically, globally, and it's just really interesting if we take a step back to just sort of see how that is affecting human beings and how we are interacting with each other, but then also how it's sort of affecting story as well. I know that I'm talking in very sort of broad general terms, but I don't really know how to go into specifics because I'm still sort of like figuring it out myself, but I think it's identity and how we see ourselves. I think there is a shift happening in media and in the types of stories that we're telling, but it's still a fight to be able to tell those stories, you know, tell stories about IBOC people, tell stories about people who are not part of the mainstream. And I think there's still an old guard who is uncomfortable with that, you know, and so trying to get past them and trying to sort of shift the way we see ourselves. It's hard for, I suppose, the people at the bottom, but it's also hard for the people at the top because it means that they might have to take a few steps down.
That's very interesting that you talk about the identity. You know, we have so many facets, and that's something that I noticed in your film. You know, it's not just about ethnic or cultural identity. It's identity as a human being. That's one thing that I really loved about Donkey Head, that is that some of the issues that were there could have been any family's issues. You know, so it's more real and not one dimensional. So I really appreciated that. Like, do you feel that some of the resistance is getting funding for the stories, or
somewhat? So just to go back to what you said about Donkey Head being, I mean, Donkey Head was always meant to be, you know, is about a family. They just happen to be South Asian. So there are elements of, you know, their culture, their Sikh Punjabi culture in the story. But it was interesting because I got a review once, and it was a review by someone who his review went into all the newspapers throughout Canada. I think it was like from the Sun or something. Anyways, he said it was, what did he call it? He called Donkey Head a South Asian story. And that really bothered me because it wasn't a South Asian story. It was a Canadian story, you know? And I think labeling that really sort of shuts out so many people who might have watched it otherwise, if it was just sort of presented in a different way. Sorry, what was funding. The funding. So it's really interesting because I have felt like over the last number of years, the funding has opened up quite dramatically, especially in Canada, specifically for features, in terms of developing, wanting to hear more stories that feel diverse. So that's really exciting. But what's interesting is mainstream films that make money still require, they're still from a very white lens. And there are markets all over the world where people go to sell films. And there's almost like an algorithm or a formula that goes into making sure that your film could get sold, you know? And one of those things is having a name in your film. And if you have a certain name, then companies will give you money to make the film because they know that they'll be able to sell the film and recoup their money. But the names that are on the list are almost all white men that they consider people that can actually sell the film. Even if they feel irrelevant these days, these names are still so powerful in sort of like more of a global market. So that really changes what you can write about and what kind of stories you can get funded.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
I think with Donkey Head that it resonates with so many families because it's about dynamic. It's about relationship. It's about, you know, overcoming barriers and hurdles and so on and so forth that every family has. So I'm interested, there was a lot of talk about identity and about culture and about race and things like that. How do you feel has the film industry helped people move to a more healthy, I guess, racial identity in that respect, but then a healthy identity just overall, not just necessarily that race piece?
Well, I think the last few years have been really interesting with Black Lives Matter, with the Me Too movement. I think we've seen those directly affect the types of stories that we're telling. So that's really interesting. And I think, you know, when you look at people like Lily Gladstone, for instance, you know, she's making huge waves and it's so exciting to see her express her fashion in the way that she does in a really accessible way, in winning awards, in, you know, really just having a certain amount of clout and power to, you know, get things made or to get things, get movies that she's a part of distributed. So that's really positive. And then when I look at, you know, last night I was watching a series on Netflix called Beef, which is a fantastic series. And also like amazing because the majority of the cast is Asian and they're like all of us, you know, and it's not about their Asianness. It's simply about their humanness. But of course their specific lens of being, you know, whether they're Korean or they're Japanese living in Los Angeles is like, there's elements of that that just make them more real. So I think we're just seeing more nuance. We're just not going from we're no longer these two-dimensional characters where we're like full human beings. And people are starting to recognize that too. So I think that's really exciting. And that's shifting the way we see ourselves, the way we see our neighbors, you know.
In definitely a positive direction. I absolutely agree. Thank you so much, Tamika.
So again, how do you process your own development of racial identity and intersectionality in the industry?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really interesting because I started acting 18 years ago. And, you know, as an actor, you can really sort of defer a lot of your power, you know, to the director, to the producers. And you want to be liked and you... there's certain sort of tips and tricks that you can use to just like, you know, make sure that you're non-threatening, but really likable in a way, you know, and I feel like I really kind of milked that for a big chunk of my career. Like I learned how to use those tactics in order to survive and thrive in an industry where if you were too strong voiced, you might be deemed as difficult. But now I'm directing. And now I'm producing, and I'm finding that those particular, like, I have to really consciously shed some of those behaviors because they don't serve me anymore. And because people need a leader, you know, they're not looking for me when I'm in those roles to be likable. They're looking for me to have a vision and to lead and to be able to manage other people's expectations. And so, I'm finding that that's really hard in some ways, especially because all of my other stuff comes up as a woman and then a woman of color, you know, where I may not, at least at the beginning, be given the credit or the benefit of the doubt if as I would have if I looked differently. If I look like, you know, a tall white man with a big voice, I would maybe have immediate credibility just by entering a room, but I don't. And so I have to find other ways to sort of allow people to trust me. I think that's really actually the biggest thing, is that as a director, as a creative person, you have to be trusted. And that trust, especially, I'm finding I have to earn that trust. I have to work really hard to make sure that people can trust me. And in the process of working really hard to make sure people can trust me, you might have to put up with a lot of people's bullshit, you know, as you're navigating it. But then you're also putting up with your own bullshit because you've been sort of raised a certain way, or you've been living your life in a certain way that you're still convincing yourself, do I have credibility here? Is that person being passive aggressive with me? Do they not trust that I can do this job? You know, so there's a lot of things that you're juggling. But I think that's probably how I feel like things are shifting for me and my own sort of understanding of my own race and my own identity.
Thank you for that. You know, it just really sounds like you have, you know, as a South Asian female director and actor, that means that you have a lot of emotional labor, much more so than, you know, some other actors to go through to do your work even. So
yeah, it's really interesting because I, you know, for the most part, I don't like to think about it because I think if you do, it just gets kind of depressing. But every so often, you know, you're kind of faced in these situations where you're like, oh gosh, like you just know that if you looked a certain way, you probably wouldn't have to be putting up with certain behaviors. But there's nothing you can do about it. So it's like, okay, so now, how do I navigate this? And how do I navigate it in a way that feels healthy to me, where I'm not, you know, feeling just sort of like the intense pressure, where I can laugh at it, where I can just also let it go and be like, oh, this is your issues. Or how can I do it in a way that feels curious, you know? And so this is an ongoing process. And I feel like I'm kind of still at the beginning of this, my own ability to do this and this journey.
I think a lot of people have just within our series and everything have spoken to that imposter syndrome. And it's just, how do you overcome that feeling that has been placed on society of, do I belong? And of course you belong to me. You're incredible. And so we've spoken at length, and I just want to extend this just by a little bit, and I think we'll move on, is the whole essence of race and the importance of race and identity, but how has that impacted the film industry? And again, we're seeing new waves and new narratives and the progression to more equity throughout the film industry. So I'm interested in, you know, knowing your stance, and you've already kind of touched on it, on the impact that race has on the industry at this point.
I think race is on everyone's mind, you know, and it's exciting because, like I mentioned, like it's stories are just becoming more nuanced, you know, and we're not just painting it all with a brush of like, okay, well, these are like the Asian characters and they all behave the same, or these are the South Asian characters and they all are the same. It's like, it's not like that. We're starting to really get into the nitty gritty of like, but where exactly are they from, and what caste system, and what are their, you know, what are their relationships with each other? And I think that's really interesting. You know, it's such a layered question in terms of race and story, because I think something that I think about quite often, and this isn't always the most popular opinion, but, you know, when I first started acting, the goal for every person, every IBPOC person was, please just, you know, don't make me, or every South Asian person was, please don't cast me as the taxi driver with the funny accent. You know, like everybody wanted to have something that felt juicier, and they wanted to play, like I wanted to play a Julie or, you know, a Sarah, not, you know, a Belinder. Now, all these years later, we're excited to play Belinders. Like I'm excited to play somebody from my own culture, because I know that the quality of that character is becoming so much more nuanced. It has so much more depth. It's more of a real person. I think what's interesting is that now there's a lot of discussion about, well, if you're gonna play Gandhi, Gandhi has to be a Hindu man that lives in this particular region in order to be able to authentically play it. Or if you're gonna play Miss Marvel, you have to be a Muslim girl because she was written to be a Muslim girl. And yes, that is true. But I guess where what I ask is, but what about the other aspects of that person? Is Gandhi was more than just a Hindu man. He was a lawyer. He was afraid of public speaking. He was a father. He was a husband. You know, Miss Marvel is, you know, an American teenager who, I don't actually know other aspects of her personality, but she was a daughter, and she's, you know, a sister. All I'm saying is our humanness is now being sort of reflected only in our race, and we are so much more than that. And so it's I don't know how you balance that out, because it is really important to cast authentically, but at the same time, where does that leave the people who are, you know, a mix of all sorts of things? Where does that leave artistry? Where does that leave the imagination to say, well, you know what, I know this about Gandhi. I know what it's like to fight for something, to starve for something. Is that worth just as much as saying, well, but my parents were Hindu, and so I'm allowed to play this character?
And I think you're speaking to the intersectionalities at play, and the fact that people are more than just their race, or more than just their gender, or more than just, you know, that the narrative has so many intersecting layers, and it's important to really understand those intersections. So thank you very much, Tomika.
If there, you know, if someone is cast as being Hindu, and that is a part of the movie that needs to be represented, then the actor being hired for the role needs to be Hindu?
I'm saying that's, I think that's always the first place that we should go, but it's, I mm-hmm. think that what is happening is that that is the only place we're going, and that there's no room for any other aspects of that human, the humanism of the character. There was a movie I did a number of years ago called Funny Boy with Deepa Mehta, that she directed it. It's based on a novel of the same name, and it's set in Sri Lanka, and it's about an upper class Christian Tamil family in the 70s and 80s. And it's a beautiful book. and a beautiful film. The book was around for 26 years before Deepa had turned it into a movie. And there was an uproar, not by all Tamils and not by all Sri Lankans, but by a few who felt like this movie should not have been made by a Hindu woman who was not Sri Lankan, and that the casting of it was wrong because there wasn't, she cast me, I'm Sikh Punjabi, she cast a Pakistani man who's Muslim, she cast people from Sri Lanka, but they were Sinhalese. She cast one woman who was half Tamil, half Sinhalese, but it wasn't good enough. And I'm not saying that they didn't have a point, but there was no discussion about it. There was no one that was that really was listening. It was just more this, like, how dare you make this film? Like, this is not, you know, you have no right. There was no one listening to the fact that, you know, this is a story about a young gay boy, and homosexuality is still considered illegal in Sri Lanka. So there was a lot of people who didn't want to audition for this role, you know. Also, nobody considered the fact that, okay, well, if she didn't make it, who would make it? And would this book still be on the shelf, you know, and not be turned into something that was beautiful? And so I just think that there's, everything's so like, everything's so black and white, you know, there's just no color. There's no ability. There's no shades of gray in terms of really kind of seeing that this is a spectrum. This is not an issue that is either good or bad. It's there's no listening. I hope that answers your question.
That does. That gives me a lot more clarity. Thank you. Sorry about that. I just,
no.
That it's such a, in a way, it's such a big topic, I think, too.
It's a huge topic. Yeah. Authorship. Yeah. Who's in charge of stories? You know,
I think it also presents so many of the barriers that still exist, you know.
It really does. Yeah. Yeah.
So in your opinion and experience, how does education factor into creating an inclusive, equitable, and anti-racist lens in the film industry?
I think
what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think education has a big part of creating an inclusive film industry on both sides. I mean, I think we need more educators who are, you know, IBPOC folk to be able to, you know, teach the stories that from their lens. And I think, you know, I think that also, it's not just about teaching stories from the perspective of, you know, in my case, you know, a South Asian Punjabi woman, but also I think story itself in the West, it's, you know, based on Greek thought, on this Eurocentric concept of like a beginning, middle, and end, a three-act structure. But when you look at other parts of the world, story is taught and explored in different ways. I'm actually writing a feature right now, and it takes place in two parts. And I've had a lot of pushback because people are like, you can't do that because you know, you have to have the three act thing. And so it's been really interesting being like, but why can't you do that? Why can't you break the rules? And so I think it would be just really interesting to bring within the educational field, just more ideas as to how we tell stories and the process of telling stories that isn't necessarily from this very sort of Eurocentric way that we've been doing it for the last number of years. But then on the other side of things, you know, within the industry itself, I think it would just be, I think people in the industry just need more education as to how we communicate with one another, what we can learn from experiences. I just recently did a postmortem for, I directed an episode of TV, and they wanted to just kind of get an understanding of what worked from the experience, what didn't work. And it was, I was in the Zoom with HR, with the producer, and with a diversity and inclusion woman. And it was the first time in my entire career that I ever had the opportunity to actually speak about my experiences and how I was affected. And they were speaking to a number of people, you know, and so just collecting data and information, which was so smart. And but that rarely happens. You know, the way the film industry works is it's a business, and it's also based on really sort of old school ideas. And so they do the things that the way they do it, it's a very sort of masculine way of like, of making art. And so there's not a lot of like process, and there's not a lot of ways to sort of allow yourself to reflect on an experience. And so I think that's why actually there's been so much talk, well, a few years ago about Me Too, is because nobody reflects. It's just sort of on to the next, and we just keep doing things the way we've always been doing this. And then it's sort of like a volcano, and then everything explodes. Whereas I think if we had just more time to process and to more discussion around that, you know, just more discussion, more space for rehearsal, more time to get to know each other. It seems like such a frou-frou thing from a money standpoint and from a producer's standpoint. But I think all of those things actually end up with a better result in the end.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Agam. Carrie?
I think that resonates with so many people, is just having that time to talk and to discuss and listen, even more importantly, to listen to each other's experiences and ideas and struggles and misfortunes and how they pick themselves up and everything. There's so much to learn from that. And I think so much to grow. And something that you had mentioned is just saying, just in the whole development of the narrative and story elements and things like that, recognizing that there's so many different ways of doing it, and not necessarily from this Eurocentric colonialist supremacist type viewpoint. So it's looking and opening up to what are the other possibilities? How might we be able to open that dialogue and explore new ways of learning, knowing, and doing? And in this respect, that's exactly it. So at that point, I would like to ask if there's anything that you would love to share that you didn't get a chance to address, that you didn't have points shared. If you would love to do that, we'd love to hear it.
I think there's just this one question about what is the South Asian narrative, which I thought was really interesting because it took me a while. It sort of stumped me. What is the South Asian narrative? And when I was thinking about it, I realized actually, because like South Asia, India specifically, is just so vast, so many different languages, so many different people, that there is like, it's so hard to actually say what the South Asian narrative is, because like as a Sikh Punjabi woman, a Sikh Punjabi is like, we're sort of displaced people, right? And so that's why there's so much immigration outside of India and to other places. And our relationship with South Asia and with India is very different than, you know, someone who's Muslim or someone who is Hindu, for instance. And so I just thought that was really interesting. And I think as a result, we haven't quite found our voice and our footing sort of in the stories that we're telling right now in the West, in Hollywood. It's happening more and more, but I, you know, when I look at other groups, I just think that it's exciting actually to see what like Korean Americans are doing, what Japanese Americans are doing. Like Beef is such an exciting series because you really are starting to see just, you know, or shows like, or movies like Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, like they're just, it's so well made and so nuanced and very, very specific. And I just think, yeah, I'm excited to kind of see where South Asians go, you know, with as we start learning more about our own identity and how we sort of fit into, you know, the West.
And I think I'm and Tamika, we can both say that we're very excited for you to keep writing and keep producing and keep directing, and so that these stories can be told and so that your voice is heard, which is really important. So we would love to thank you so much to our guest, Agam Darshi, for your very thoughtful, very impactful, very enlightening responses to our questions today that address the behind the lens and navigating identity within film industry. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Agam. You know, you really helped us unpack anti-racism in a clear and dynamic way. You are extraordinary, and you are opening so many doors for people that come after you. You know, it's just amazing. So as mentioned prior to the presentation, our intention for this speaker series is to eradicate racism through small and large steps towards change. So as such, we've created a call to action to move the teachings and learnings from today's podcast session forward. So we challenge every listener of today's podcast to participate in one act of change. Now, this could be having a conversation with a neighbor or colleague about something that resonated with you from today's podcast. It could be creating an interactive lesson, a workshop or session on anti-Asian racism with the inclusion of voices of all peoples, including the South Asian community, to share with your students, colleagues, peers, or staff. You might also create a subset presentation or a podcast to react to the discussion on today's session for communities to draw awareness to the issue. We ask that you continue the conversation by sharing what you will do to implement the contents from today's talk into your personal and or professional life using the hashtag MET and hashtag UBC anti-racism. Carrie?
Thank you so much, Tamika, and to you, Agam. So when it comes to the availability of impactful, culturally sensitive and relevant lesson plans that address anti-racism, we're kind of faced with these limited resources that are available. So we are urging, as a grander gesture for any of our listeners for today's session, to submit a lesson plan that aligns with the content from the interview with Agam Darshi with your curriculum in an attempt to create good quality anti-South Asian racism resources and to put these in the hands of educators. So this lesson plan call to action, it can be found on the MET website. We'll include the hyperlink for that. And here you'll find the lesson plan templates, the submission criteria, and some of the lesson plans will be chosen and published on the MET website and may receive a grant offered by Edith Lando Virtual Learning Center to create additional digital resources which support your lesson plan. And all lesson plan entries, including grades K to 12, post-secondary graduate studies, are encouraged and welcome. So one last thank you, a very heartfelt thank you to our guest for today, Agam Darshi. It has been such an incredible pleasure learning from you, listening to you, and seeing the incredible work that you're doing out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, this is just really exciting. It's so nice to sort of speak about this work in this way. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. And thank you to all our listeners and watchers for joining us.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.